watch. Hey everyone, is this working?
Okay. Well, it's nice to be here at Perimeter and to see some of the new, or I guess, second semester in Sci students that I haven't seen before. So for all you Sci kids, I'm basically gearing this talk towards you. So feel free to interrupt me, ask questions. If you need clarification, stuff like that, I like to keep things informal to a fault. So this is work I'm going to talk about that I did recently with Matt Hastings and Sergey Izakov, which is on fractionalization and spin liquids and the way we simulate them. Some of the preliminary work was done basically as far back as 2010 with my group over at Waterloo. And I'll mention some of this stuff when I talk about the entanglement entropy in spin liquids a little bit. So this is my group. Most of them are here. Summer students are expendable, so you know Photoshop's amazing. But the outline of the talk is basically I'm going to give you an introduction to what we do in condensed matter in terms of the context of emergence and especially looking at emergent quasiparticles. And part of this fractionalization and spin liquids and topological order and stuff is sort of germane to this overall theme of emergence. I'll talk a bit about the simulation methods that we use. And then I'll look at a specific model or a set of models that are that host a phase called the quantum spin liquid. And the quantum spin liquid is sort of the interesting phase with which the fractional quasiparticles that we're going to discuss emerges from. So the last part of the talk, I will look at some recent interesting work that we did that looks at the universality of these fractional particles and how they affect a quantum critical point. Okay, so that's the preliminaries. So we do condensed matter physics, and I don't really need to give an introduction probably to that. I mean, you might be used to thinking of condensed matter as a study of materials or phases or phase transitions or something like that. But to frame the problems that I'm going to discuss, I think it's nice to think of condensed matter systems as sort of a playground for looking at this idea of emergence. And you know, emergence is a term that's become popular, especially within condensed matter, the condensed matter community. It's really been advocated strongly by Bob Laughlin, and you can read this quote here. You know, Bob Laughlin really believes that this idea of emergence challenges even particle physics or the reductionist view of physics as sort of the most important thing that we should be thinking about as physicists. And although I don't necessarily ascribe to all of his philosophies, what's interesting with Laughlin historically is Bob Laughlin was the guy who won the Nobel Prize for explaining the fractional quantum Hall effect. So these ideas that I'm going to talk about with fractional particles emerging from liquid-like ground states and so on, I think is really tied to this idea of emergence. And in some sense, I really think it guided Bob Laughlin in thinking about these ideas of emergence in condensed matter systems. So of course, there's a whole underlying philosophy that has to do with emergence, and I'm not sophisticated enough to look at that. I look at specific examples of emergence, both theoretically, but also I like to observe emergence. So when I was living in Tennessee, it's only a few miles south of Knoxville. You can drive into the Smoky Mountains. And in the Smoky Mountains, you can find these synchronous fireflies. So synchronous fireflies, which this is a video of here, are basically fireflies that gather together during the mating season or whatever they do in June, and they synchronize their flashes. And that synchronous flashing is an example of an emergent phenomenon in like a biological system, right? So what's the definition of emergent? In this context, there's a synchronized flash of the fireflies, and you can't explain or you can't predict that synchronized flashing merely by looking at the biology of individual fireflies, right? So the synchronous flashing is some very complex behavior that comes from all the fireflies together and all of their interactions and communication and so on. So I think that's sort of the essence of emergence that I'm trying to get across in this talk, is that there's certain phenomena, not only in biological systems, but in matter, materials, in the universe itself, that we don't know how to predict from first principles or from sort of a fundamental reductionist view. And condensed matter really is the test bed or the testing ground for looking at these ideas of emergence. So you can argue that in matter, there's many examples of emergence from phases themselves. What makes a superconducting phase superconducting, or phase transitions, or broken symmetries, right? Or even the emergence of global symmetries or gauge symmetries and stuff like that. But I mean, this is too broad of a topic and almost bordering on you know, the idea of emergence there almost borders on a philosophy, I mean. But we can really look at specific examples of emergence in condensed matter. And I find the most interesting one to be this idea of a quasiparticle or a quasiparticle excitation. And so everyone's taking condensed matter, so you've definitely studied phonons. And so phonons are a quasiparticle excitation that occurs as a lattice vibration of a crystal, right? And so in the crystalline phase at low temperature, you get these basically lattice vibrations that are described by a boson creation annihilation operator, which means that they're essentially indistinguishable from a fundamental boson from that sort of level of formalism. And you can take this analogy further and say that, you know, wonder about particles in the universe itself and whether they're emergent and so on, but all restricted condensed matter systems. So phonons are sort of an example of a fundamental bosonic particle that's sort of conventional in a sense. We understand it, we see it in nature and in the free vacuum. But there's also exotic quasiparticles. And so like a spin charge separated quasiparticle is another classic example. So you take the electron has two fundamental quantum numbers, the charge and the spin. And under normal circumstances, you can't break these things apart. But if you put the electron in just the right background, you know, vacuum, let's say, as excitation out of the vacuum, then you can see the spin and charge separately propagate with different velocities. So this is well studied in the context of Luttinger liquids. So here's a 160-site Luttinger liquid being simulated. And here's basically the wave packet is associated with the spin quantum number as a function of time. And here's the charge. So you can see that these things propagate with different velocities. So in essence, they're entirely separate quasiparticles that exist as excitations in that vacuum. So the one I'm going to talk about, fractionalization, often, you know, is related to spin charge separation in the sense that you're splitting up quantum numbers. But in this sense, you're splitting up the same number, which is the fundamental charge. And so again, this is what Laughlin and others, you know, discovered is the mechanism behind fractional quantum Hall states, right? Where the electron is split into quasiparticles of charge 1/3. Also associated with that Laughlin state or variations of those fractional quantum Hall states is particles with quasiparticles with exotic statistics, and so many people here study that, non-abelian braiding and so on. And these are quite interesting in the context of topological quantum computing. So the thing that all of these share, especially the exotic ones, right, but all of them, is that these quasiparticles emerge from a different material ground state, which you could describe as a vacuum state, right, the low temperature ground state of the system. So in the phonon case, the ground state is the crystal itself, right? These things live as crystal, as lattice vibrations in the crystal. Spin charge separation, again, the Luttinger liquid. Fractional quantum Hall liquid or state here is basically the ground state vacuum for both of these things. And so in order to study these sort of exotic particles, all you have to do is create the correct ground state vacuum that supports these things as emergent particles. And you'll notice that one word I used in common for a lot of these was liquid. And so what we study here in my group is basically a type of ground state vacuum we call a quantum spin liquid. And a quantum spin liquid is a lot like what it sounds like. It's a fluid-like state of matter, but it's a fluid-like state of the spins of a magnetic system or something like that. So inside of this magnetic system, spins can be ordered. So imagine I have some quantum parameter, like maybe a magnetic field or something here. I can order all my spins on a lattice to point in one direction, and there's an order parameter associated with that, the magnetization. Or I can disorder the system with some quantum fluctuation, say, and I can get myself into a disordered state. So that disordered state in a zero temperature magnetic material or a spin material is actually a highly correlated state. So it's not just a sort of non-interacting liquid. Quite typically, and perhaps as a rule, these things are strongly correlated. And they break the Landau paradigm in the sense that there's no order parameter associated with them. So I'll talk about that. So I might mention these things as examples of non-Landau states of matter. And it really just means that, you know, they break this idea that the order parameter, that there's an order parameter associated with the order. So that's interesting in and of itself. But we're also interested in these things because they, as a rule, support exotic collective phenomenon. Just like all the fireflies, you know, flashing in unison. These things support, you know, basically quasiparticle excitations that can be exotic, and they emerge from this background liquid state. Topological order, which I'll talk about, you know, emergent gauge structures, which are related to that type of thing. Okay, so this is really, from my point of view, what's interesting about these spin liquid states, is that they give you sort of an alternate universe or a different universe within which to study these exotic particles that don't exist within our own universe. Well, so the question is, do these universes exist in nature? And I think the answer is a tentative yes. I mean, spin liquids are relatively scarce in known materials. So last year, Leon Balentz basically published his table of all the sort of known experimental candidates for quantum spin liquids. And there's been a couple additions or subtractions to this table, but it's fairly comprehensive. These things range from organics to like magnets, magnetic materials, like conventional things that you might imagine a spin liquid living in. One thing they all share in common, or almost all of them, is a low spin. So a very quantum mechanical a spin, which resides on the lattice. And also a geometrically frustrated lattice, so triangular lattice or Kagame lattice, which I'll show lots of pictures of. And this one that's sort of my favorite these days is this Herbert Smithite, which I'll talk a bit about, which is a very close realization of a pure spin 1/2 Hamiltonian on a Kagame lattice. And this is basically the sort of rough features of the models that I'll be looking at. So spin liquids are rare. We don't study them experimentally. We study them with lattice models. Okay. And
the last one was spin 2, is that right?
Yeah, actually, I don't know much about this one.
Like graviton?
Yeah, I
was Next slide. So we study these in the context of lattice models.
Actually, you know, that's a bipartite lattice too, right? So it kind of broke the rule in terms of frustration. So quantum lattice models, there's two ways to motivate yourself to study these things. And one is to try to build a model which most accurately represents your favorite material. So say I really was interested in Herbert Smithite, I'll show you procedures how we do this. You know, look in detail at the interactions and the consequences of the interactions on measurable quantities, and try to get out a Hamiltonian which most accurately represents it. That's not really what I do. So what I do more is I construct models that are designed to capture the essential physics. And so the models themselves should have some realistic element to them. But really what I'm more interested in is, you know, which ingredients are necessary in a model to give us, you know, X exotic behavior. So what ingredients do I need to get a spin liquid, or to get a fractional particle with charge 1/2, or to get an emergent topological structure or something like that? And you can basically connect between these things, but you know, it's a challenge in quantum systems. So part of the challenge comes from actually just solving these models, right? So I've written down a model. Here's like a Heisenberg model, isotropic Heisenberg spins, quantum spin 1/2, say. I can do bosons, which is very similar. I'll talk about hardcore bosons. So for example, for the spin 1/2 case, you have an exponential Hilbert space, which you know, right? So there's two states, spin up, spin down, 2 to the n. And if I wanted to even just represent that Hilbert space, just to store that thing, for example, on a computer, I need, you know, 2 to the n storage for that, and something bigger for the matrix for the Hamiltonian itself. So that Hilbert space for like a 3x3 lattice, if I'm thinking of two dimensions, would be 2 to the 9, which is 512 or something like that. That's no problem, right? So what we're talking about though is studying emergent quantities, which typically happen on sort of larger length scales. And so we're interested in making these lattices as big as possible. We want to approach, if we can, the thermodynamic limit or some approximation of it, or scale into the thermodynamic limit in a way that, you know, we have a big enough system so that we can see, you know, quasi-particles moving around in the lattice or something like that. And the problem is, this exponential Hilbert space kills us right away. So if we have a 40 spin system, I think we need like 20 terabytes, which is like the memory that was in Watson. Remember Watson? Yeah. So I think it's a 22 terabyte memory in that thing, which contained all the answers for Jeopardy. You know, as you go to 256, which in a lattice model is just 16 by 16, right? 16 by 16 square lattice. You're already looking at all, you know, yet in order to store the Hilbert space, you'd have to employ every single particle in the known universe. With I forget if that's with or without dark matter. Whatever, right? The point is that it's basically impossible. So it looks like we can't solve models exactly, you know. You know, with the caveat that if quantum computers came out, we'd be in a different position. But if I'm just thinking of stuff that's going to happen in basically my career, you know, we can't solve these things exactly. You know, getting the full spectrum and all the excited properties of these things, it's essentially impossible. for most lattice models, but it doesn't really mean we're stuck. And I mean, it wouldn't mean we're stuck or else I wouldn't be here. So the way we get around this is we don't directly store the Hilbert space, we don't exactly diagonalize a Hamiltonian, but we sample the Hilbert space in its most important sectors, or something analogous to that. And the way we do this is with Monte Carlo simulations. And so you've heard of Monte Carlo simulations, perhaps. They're pretty ubiquitous in, you know, physics, chemistry, biology, you know, biophysics, stuff like that. And there's several reasons why. So the basis of Monte Carlo simulations is that they stochastically sample the important sample, whatever configuration space is you're looking at. So for us, I'm going to show you what the configuration space is. For a protein, it could be all the possible protein configurations or something like that, right? So there's a sampling. There's a fundamental statistical sampling, which gives the method statistical errors. But otherwise, if you can implement the thing correctly, it's unbiased. And people who do protein folding, for example, know that it's not always easy to give yourself an unbiased Monte Carlo dynamics. But for the purposes of this talk, I'm assuming that we can essentially attack these things in the proper manner. So all the error bars we have are statistical. And it, like I said, it's ubiquitous, and it's also ancient, if ancient is the right word, because, you know, the development of Monte Carlo was tied to the development of digital computers and even analog computers before then. So like Monte Carlo as a method was basically invented in Los Alamos in, you know, the 46 to 50s, when these guys were looking at simulating. I think the essential problem was basically how far a neutron penetrates into a material before it hits the nucleus of an atom, right? And so the equations can in principle be written down, but there's all these stochastic paths that this thing can take. And those things were summed over with Monte Carlo computers. So the hardware, this is the ENIAC machine, you know, the hardware of these machines was developed, you know, in some sense in collaboration with people who directly wanted to look at Monte Carlo simulations. And this is how they programmed them. You know, grad students, you got it tough these days, right? Imagine doing that. There was no VI back then. So now, Monte Carlo is just evolved along with computers until we're at the state we are today, where we can do all sorts of modern algorithms, right? Implemented on modern hardware. And quantum Monte Carlo is the flavor of Monte Carlo that I use, which simply means that you're sampling some sort of non-trivial configuration space, not just, you know, configuration of proteins or spin configurations, but really what you're sampling is basis configurations and world lines or some equivalent, you know, Feynman path representation of the paths of these particles in D plus one dimensional space. So I'd say as a defining property, quantum Monte Carlo is something that happens not in the spatial dimension D, but in a D plus one simulation cell. And it's the D plus one configurations that you're actually sampling. So for here, here's a one dimensional system of spins. And I've expanded this thing into the D plus one. This is the plus one direction, so one plus one. And you can imagine how you could do that by expanding an exponential, if you wish, in the partition function. And so I'm not only just sampling spins down and spins up, but I'm sampling the path of those spins as they take through this higher dimensional space. Okay, and so this is like a world line for that particle. If you associate that spin up with the boson density, it's the world line of the bosons. And that's effectively done through sampling Hamiltonian operators, which are either diagonal or off-diagonal. Okay, so there's a whole sophisticated, you know, set of procedures that we use in order to do this type of quantum Monte Carlo sampling. The neat thing about it is it doesn't require, you know, massive computers, although massive computers like this is Cynet in Toronto are nice. But, you know, you could actually implement fairly reasonable quantum and classical Monte Carlo codes on reasonable-sized desktop top computers. And some of the data that I'll actually show you in this talk, I just ran on a 12-core Mac Pro basically in my office. So, you know, the reason that this is possible is that this procedure in its best implementation scales as n. So instead of being exponential in n, 2 to the n, this thing scales linear in n. And so there's not much difference when things are scaling linear in n between your Commodore 64 and the supercomputer, really. So that's enough of that. I won't talk anymore about the quantum Monte Carlo itself. So I'm going to look at some specific lattice models now. So any questions on the stuff that I glossed over? So we're going to look at lattice models of quantum spin liquids, essentially. And we're solving these things with quantum Monte Carlo. So there's many different types of, question?
Quantum Monte Carlo in general. So is it limited to equilibrium? Or, I mean, I'm asking that because normally when you do it in other contexts, you need to weak rotate, so you get a real amplitude to deal with, the real action.
Yeah, so the simple answer is yes, it's restricted to equilibrium. So we're actually going to only look at equilibrium properties here.
So you never have to deal with complex amplitudes.
You don't have to deal with complex amplitudes, but you do, in a quantum sense, sometimes have to deal with negative probabilities, which is a problem for us.
So that's almost the same problem.
It is the same problem, yeah. So if you'll notice, I'm glossing over certain fermionic and frustrated spin models because these things give you that problem. It's called the sign problem for us. And so actually, there's a huge amount of models that are precluded from a quantum Monte Carlo sampling. You know, that's a fundamental problem with the stochastic nature of this. I mean, we're
looking at positive probabilities, right? Because that in the spirit of Monte Carlo, and one of the constraints or the drawbacks of quantum Monte Carlo is you can't always define a positive definite probability from quantum Hamiltonians. But I'm going to get by that problem by making sure that the lattice models I look at always have positive definite probabilities associated with them. So it's actually a small subset of all possible quantum Hamiltonians. So we have two issues. We want to have a quantum Hamiltonian that we can simulate, and we all want to have one that has an interesting property. And what I'm looking for is a quantum spin liquid ground state. And it's only been about 10 years or so that we've known which types of models satisfy both of these conditions. And that's thanks to work by these gentlemen up here. And you know, that work was all theoretical. It was merely, you know, looking at, you know, various models and configurations of systems and trying to find ones that were easy to simulate. And it's been in the last sort of 4 or 5 years that we've been implementing these things and really playing around with them on computers. So one I think Hamiltonian that's sort of easy-ish to see how spin liquids evolve is from this two-part Hamiltonian, which is written in terms of spin 1/2 operators here. But you can also map these things to hardcore bosons, very simply. And so the spin up is basically a boson density there, and a spin down is the boson gone. And how is this thing a liquid state? Well, I can construct this model because I know there's two ingredients that we need for a quantum spin liquid. And one is disorder in the ground state, so there's no ordering structure for all of these spins or bosons. And the first term of this Hamiltonian guarantees that, and what it does is it energetically favors having three spins up and three spins down around each hexagonal plaquette on this Kagame lattice. Okay, so I'm going to restrict talking to this Kagame lattice. And so you can convince yourself that if you cool your classical, if you will, or your diagonal part of your Hamiltonian into the ground state, you get this sort of liquid state where none of these bosons or none of these hexagonal plaquettes order in the same way as another one. So it's disordered. It's like the liquid I'm looking for. It's highly correlated because this is an interacting Hamiltonian, but you have this high degree of constraint on each hexagon. And then in order to get a quantum spin liquid, I add basically an off-diagonal hopping piece, which gives me a quantum kinetic energy. And what that does is flip spins or bosons back and forth around this bow tie plaquette. And this gives me the dynamics of a quantum mechanical fluctuation without breaking the constraint that's required to give me this liquid state. And so it's sort of a simple way of seeing a quantum spin liquid, how a quantum spin liquid might emerge. But that was by no means an exact solution of that model, right? And the way that these models are solved in the general phase space or the general phase diagram of these interactions is with quantum Monte Carlo. So this is a schematic phase diagram that was sort of gleaned from quantum Monte Carlo on a related model. And it's actually, you can think of it as being the same. The only thing I've done is change the quantum hopping for being across a bow tie to being a single site hopping. So this is exchange or hopping of a spin. And so that effective bow tie move is like a second order, it's like a second order effective move in this type of hopping. But it doesn't really matter, just a detail. We can solve this thing with quantum Monte Carlo. And for large T, we get ourselves into a ferromagnetic state in the spin language or a superfluid state. And I mean, this is somehow an interesting emergent phase in and of itself, where you get this long range, it's like a superconductor, we get this long range phase coherence across the entire sample. But what I'm interested in is when I increase the sign of V, and I find myself in this, what I call the topological spin liquid state. And I'll explain more what that means. So how do we know that we're in some sort of spin liquid state? Well, the definition is that it's like a liquid. So if I look at things like structure factors, so if I Fourier transform the spin-spin correlation function, as you know from condensed matter, when you have crystalline structure, you get Bragg peaks and a structure factor. So in first order, I can look at structure factors, which incidentally is also the best way, or one of the best ways, to take your Hamiltonian and see if it actually corresponds to any real material. So stuff like this, you know, structure factors and so on are basically well studied using neutron scattering and other techniques. So for example, here's some, you know, big single crystal of Herbert Smithite. I can compare my structure factor and see if it corresponds. It actually looks nothing like it. So I know that this Hamiltonian is not the microscopic Hamiltonian of Herbert Smithite. But anyway, so I can sort of convince myself that I'm in a liquid state, but really I have to eliminate all possible symmetries of the ground state, all the possible broken symmetries. And there could be dimer order, there could be different types of chiral order or something like that. So there's actually a better way to look at the spin liquid.
So what you showed there, that was for a lattice or for a spin liquid, this a structure function?
So the liquid lives on the lattice. The Kagame lattice is the background structure. If it's a liquid, what I mean is that the spins don't order in any repeating pattern on the lattice. Okay?
Okay.
So it's a liquid that lives on the lattice. It's a liquid in the sense that there's no, this is the structure factor of only the spin degrees of freedom,
yes,
as they are constrained to that Kagame lattice.
So is
lattice
there a repeating pattern here? I guess.
Yeah, there's some symmetry, right?
So this is not a liquid.
This is a liquid because there's no Bragg peaks. So you have to have a Bragg peak. Maybe it's hard to see, but you would see, for example, the intensity of one of these peaks, which is the maximum is here, say this thing would have to be basically infinitely sharp as you go to the thermodynamic.
So it's like
way.
This is not infinitely sharp, that's
right.
The point. Okay.
Yeah. So there's always structures and there's symmetries that have to do with the underlying lattice. But in order to, you know, sort of see ordering, or in order to convince yourself that it's ordering, you have to convince yourself of just Bragg peaks. There's many other ways to do this. This is just sort of one example. So let me look at the underlying structure of this spin liquid, and in a sort of schematic representation, and we can see how this thing is. We can see a way to prove that this thing's a spin liquid without somehow eliminating all possible symmetry breaking. And so to do that, we can imagine that we're in the spin liquid state, which I claimed was. So now it's a liquid because my Kagame lattice is intact, but each one of these physical bosons or spin ups, if you will, is in some sort of non-repeating pattern. There's no unit cell. There's no symmetry breaking on top of this lattice structure. And you can imagine with my quantum fluctuation terms, whatever they are, these bosons are just hopping around subject to the constraint that there's 3 per hexagon. That's a liquid state. That's the simplest example, basically, we can look at. But now let me create an excitation in this. So let me pop out that boson. So that's a charge 1 excitation. So if these are physical bosons, say they're atoms on an optical lattice or something like that, or electrons in a solid, that defect is the charge 1 defect. And what I'm going to do is associate that charge 1 defect with both of these, with half of it, with each of these hexagons, which contain the defect and the constraint, which is two particles per hexagon instead of 3. So actually, these are what I'm calling fractional charges. So these things can be confined if, for example, the thing that the spin liquid want to do is just pop that boson back, or they can be deconfined and roam around. And in these particular spin liquids, these things are deconfined, and the mechanism by which they are deconfined is the quantum fluctuation. So imagine I fluctuate quantum mechanically by hopping this physical boson to this next site. So what happens is the defect that was associated with this plaquette moves down to this one, which now has 2. And, you know, depending on the specific energetics of the system, this is the mechanism of deconfinement when these two now charge 1/2 red objects, you know, live independently in the system. So these charge 1/2 objects, you can also connect them with a string, and this will be useful for us. And so let me hop around a bit more. So let me do another quantum fluctuation where I move the defect. So I move my charge 1/2 object. And then I can annihilate the 2 charge 1/2s into a single charge 1 by adding a boson back here and regaining that energy cost that I had associated with removing that site. So actually an alternate way to describe the ground state of this thing is by a gas of these loops. So these loops are moving around with quantum fluctuations and being broken and recombined with those fractional charges.
And that, by sort of definition, is a loop gas. And for those of you who've studied any of these sort of Levin-Wend models or toric code type models, you know that the ground state of these things, which are quantum spin liquids, are also described by a fluctuating loop gas, okay? So what we have is sort of an emergent picture of the ground state that's coming from the microscopics. And this thing has a non-trivial topological structure in addition to the fractional charges that live in it. And that is associated with, if I created those two defects, I could have wound one of those defects around my lattice. And that's why I drew my lattice on a cylinder. Rob?
What if these loops just collapse in on themselves with these things in mind? Like, what keeps that structure what it is?
So this is a simplified picture of what the structure actually is. And the way you define a structure is actually you associate a dimer going between the dual lattice every time there's a boson, and then you have to define a reference state and overlap those things. And those things can have loops that have size zero, but they can also essentially loops that move around like this and don't collapse. So that didn't answer the question, but
keeping it out, that's I guess what I'm missing.
What's the
physics? If I got rid of that loop, that's just a different set of bosons.
Right.
So how does it know there's a loop there at all?
Well, there's different, the loops aren't uniquely defined, is one way to look at it in this model. But you can also, you can remove the bosons and describe the entire thing as a bunch of self-avoiding loops. And in this case, loops actually intersect and stuff. I mean, it's not the, I can draw it all out for you. I'm trying to avoid doing that.
Okay, I'll ask you later.
So yeah. Maybe a related question, can I assign an energy which is proportional to the length of the loop, or?
So in this case, these loops are gapped out.
Gapped out.
Yeah, so there's no energy associated with
okay.
the defects,
okay.
The distance. But that's not always the case, right? So like in this stuff Michel's Gingras studies, these monopoles in spin ice, which is essentially the same mechanism there. In that case, you have a confining, so if you're just in the dimer model case or whatever, the ground state of your system is like a loop gas, but you have some confining entropic, confining potential, if you will, between your. So in the physics, in my case, which I'm totally glossing over, which is actually non-trivial, I mean, these things don't have any energetics associated with them, except for some stuff that I'll talk about. So these, in my model, these things are completely deconfined, and that's non-trivial. I mean, that's a good question. I just sort of glossed over it. They are deconfined. They're deconfined, and they
also have this non-trivial topology. Okay, so if you break a loop, you can move the fractional charge around this cylinder and recombine it, and then you've made a loop that you can't destroy without doing a similar procedure. So you need to have this non-local, basically series of moves, which is by almost by definition topological, in order to get this non-trivial loop structure. And actually, that if I was pressed, is basically the defining characteristic of a quantum spin liquid, is the fact that it has an emergent topological degeneracy in the ground state. And it has to do with the sort of details of this loop structure. And whether or not your topological degeneracy is twofold or fourfold or threefold or something like that, which basically defines, in some sense, an emergent gauge symmetry. I mean, the number that is associated with that topological degeneracy in a very real way defines the quantum spin liquid. So it's more than just fluctuating spins. It's this emergent topological structure. So we're going to use that as a tool, actually. And this is really a paradigm sort of promoted a lot by Shaogun. So we call it the MIT paradigm. You can call it the perimeter paradigm soon. And that's that, this topological order that's associated with spin liquids is the defining property of these things in their liquid state. And it's also measurable. And it's measurable through something we call long-range entanglement. And so I'm just going to give a few slides on what this means. So entanglement scaling is, in some sense, a probe of topological order. And what I want to use entanglement for is a substitute for this order parameter. So here I have, remember my order parameter that has to do with my magnetization? On this side, I have a liquid state. But now I've argued that a quantum spin liquid state has to have an emergent topological order. And that topological order is associated with some entanglement quantity. Okay, so I've replaced my fluctuating spin picture with a topological picture. And that topological picture has some sort of entanglement quantity that I, in some sense, can use as a substitute for the order parameter. And in this way, we don't have to look at structure factors. If we can measure this thing that I've called gamma, we don't have to eliminate all possible symmetries. We don't have to look directly for fractionalization, look at the dynamics of it, wonder about, you know, the emergent loop structure and the microscopic mapping and so on. All we have to do is look at this gamma, and it's a universal indicator of what type of ground state we have and what type of topological order we have. And so just to, I think certain aspects of this are interesting, so just to sort of go through it quickly. What we would look at is entanglement entropies between two regions. So I have a region A entangled with a region B. So we can quantify this with either a von Neumann entanglement entropy, where rho A is a reduced density matrix. I trace out the degrees of freedom of B. Or I can look at these things I call a Reni entanglement entropy, which is what I actually measure. So this is really a quantification of the entanglement between the regions, or one way of quantifying it. It's zero if they're unentangled, and so on and so forth. And what I'm really asking is, what I would really want to know is, how does the entanglement of some region A in a large sort of, you know, material system or quantum many body system scale with the boundary of that system? And so if I zoomed in on there, that could be my lattice, you know, a bunch of my lattice sites are in region A and a bunch of my other lattice sites are in region B. And so I'm going to claim that the ground state wave functions of typical condensed matter systems, so not all condensed matter systems and not all quantum many body systems, but basically local Hamiltonians with finite correlation lengths, obey this thing which is called a boundary law, or in 3 plus 1 we would call an area law. And this is just a coefficient. So there's a non-universal coefficient and the length of that boundary. Okay, so actually this is really interesting in and of itself. So whether or not, you know, this conjecture is true is sort of a topic of that we study a lot. But it has something to do with holography in a way that, like, you know, all the information that is contained, you know, in the entanglement between these two regions is really just contained on the surface that separates the two regions out somehow. And this is not a generally true property, but it's something that seems to emerge again out of condensed matter Hamiltonians. So all the set of ground state wave functions seem to obey this thing. So I'm not really interested in that per se, but I'm interested in the fact that subleading corrections to this thing can be universal. Okay, and we can actually use these things to detect exotic quantum phases and phase transitions. So if I'm in certain situations, I can get universal subleading corrections to this thing. And some of these are well known. And lucky for us, one of them which is well calculated or well studied is this so-called topological entanglement entropy. So it's the piece that identifies, you know, the emergent loop structure, if you will, of the spin liquid. And that's that thing I call gamma. And that thing's manifest as basically subtracting off from this non-universal area law piece. And so for a Z2 spin liquid, this thing that I showed you, which is called that because the topological invariant is either an even or odd number of these loops going around the torus, going around the cylinder, this thing is log 2. Okay? And actually, the reason I mention this is because, you know, people at Perimeter had a big part in calculating this. So Alyosha, Steve Flamia, Alyosha, and Taylor Hughes and Shaogun Wen recently showed that this thing's independent of Reni index, for example, for those of you who are interested. And Mike Levin and Shaogun Wen showed us how to extract gamma in a very nice numerical way from doing entanglement entropy measures. And basically, we have to measure the entanglement entropy on 4 different structures. These ones give me 2 gamma contributions because they're non-trivial topologically. These ones are sort of simpler topologically. They give me 1 gamma. What I'm left with is 2 gamma.
So the fact that this gamma is a constant, meaning, you know, independent of the perimeter of the subsystem, does it say that, you know, it describes some sort of infinite range entanglement?
Not infinite range,
but low range.
It describes, so the reason it's a constant is it describes the long range entanglement that's like associated with each one of those loops, yeah. So it's longer range than just a simple like dimer crossing the, or a singlet crossing the boundary. But what it really means is you know a bit of information when you know you have a loop structure in the ground state, like a bit, like a literal bit of information. And that is, you know, it's not, you don't know how many loops are entering or leaving this region, and that's encapsulated in this non-universal piece here.
But once you know a loop enters, you know it has to leave. So in the, I didn't convince anyone that I actually have a loop loop structure in my ground state. But once you know what you do, you have a bit of information. And if you imagine doing your entropy is the number of microstates. So if it's some number to n, it's actually some number like 2 to the n minus 1. And so that's why I get a log 2 out of there. So it's not infinite range, but it's long-range entanglement. And that's why I wrote long-range entanglement back here. This is the paradigm for basically these non-Landau phases. I want to add a slide for the experts who work on the Torr code. So lots of you work on the Torr code here.
So the topological entanglement entropy is well studied in the Torr code. Okay, it's known to be 2 gamma, in the simplest ground state. So that thing's log 2. It's like the Z2 spin liquid I've talked about. And if you've studied this thing as a function of temperature, that log 2 is realized in 2 plateaus. Each one of these plateaus comes from a different defect in the system, in the loop structure. So there's 2 types of loop structures in the Torr code. And if you create a defect in one, it's actually an energetic defect that corresponds to an electric defect. And that has some energy. And that's like when you warm up enough, you get a bunch of these electric defects. You fall into the second plateau. And that second plateau is destroyed by a second type of defect, which is called a magnetic defect. Okay, and that also has to do with the Hamiltonian. So there's a 2 plateau structure. So I'm going to show you simulation results on my system now, where I've measured the topological entanglement entropy on this Kagame lattice, and I'm looking down here. And I've actually plotted this as a function of 1 over temperature. But let's focus on the topological spin liquid. And I see a 2 plateau structure emerge. Okay, so now this is real data on my quantum Monte Carlo simulation, so it's not perfect, right? If I zoom into this plateau structure, I see that the discrepancy I'm seeing here is a finite size effect. So if I go from this is an 8x8x3 lattice. If I go to 16x16x3, 24x24x3, I quantize these things exactly on the log 2 that I expect for this topological spin liquid state. So that's interesting. I can positively identify the ground state, the emergent ground state structure of my spin liquid as a loop gas without having to answer Rob's question about like the microscopics of the loops. Because this thing is universal. And if it's log 2, then I know I have a Z2 spin liquid. And if I have a 2 plateau structure, I haven't quite reached a second plateau because my simulation's crapped out. Those 2 plateaus are associated with 2 defects, 2 different types of defects in that loop structure, which are also universal. Okay, so that's one point. I've finished this section. I got a spin liquid. It's kind of tricky to see what's going on microscopically, but these quantum information ideas, this entanglement entropy, helps me realize what the ground state structure of that is. And not only does it tell me what the ground state structure of my Hamiltonian is, it gives me hints of the emergent particles which exist. So the electric particle in the Torr code corresponds to my fractional charge. The magnetic defect, which I know is there because I have this 2 plateau structure, corresponds to like a vison or something in my system. It's some other emergent particle which I haven't characterized. And if we study the Torr code, we know that this thing also has an emergent fermion. So for those of you who look at it. And this emergent fermion in principle should occur in my Hamiltonians, although I don't know how to observe it or something like that. But you see the nice thing about these simulations is that we have this microscopic Hamiltonian. We put it on a lattice. I mean, there's all these questions about what's going on in terms of the microscopics. But once I understand sort of the emergent structure, then I know, from comparison to maybe simpler models, exactly what's going on in my system. And in my system, I definitely have fractional particles associated with the electric and magnetic defects, so the fractional charges and the magnetic charges. And now we have an interesting prediction. Do I have an emergent fermion? Okay, so that got a little technical. Sorry. So I want to talk a little bit about fractionalization at quantum critical points. Okay, so any questions on the stuff I just finished?
I'm just going to go over this real quick in like 5 minutes, and you guys can ask me about this later if you're interested. So I've convinced you that, or maybe I've failed to convince you that, I have a quantum spin liquid ground state, and I can study these emergent properties of it.
The quasi-particles, also the sort of emergent topological structure. Okay, So now I want to ask, well, okay, so that's nice that you have a specific model, but is there anything universal about this? Is there anything about the exotica that's emerged in that thing, say these fractional charge particles, which affects, you know, the rest of the world or the rest of the universe? Because if I haven't tied my model to a specific material and there's nothing universal about my results, then maybe who cares, right? So that's what this is, fractionalization at a quantum critical point. So a quantum critical point exists in this model and I can study it. And a quantum critical point is interesting because of the very fact that it's universal, okay? So for example, my quantum critical point's right there. If I cool from the topological spin liquid into the superfluid phase, I should be able to study the universality of that thing. And the universality, you know, is basically model independent. It only depends on symmetries of the Hamiltonian, you know, the symmetry of the ground state, the dimensionality, stuff like that, right? It sort of transcends all, you know, of the specific material Hamiltonians or the field theories or whatever is that it is that you like to study. So in this case, we think we know what the universality class is because quote-unquote naive measurements show us that it's in the so-called XY universality class. And that's the associated symmetry of the transition. It's a 3D XY universality class because at zero temperature, this is like a 2+1 model. And I can do a simple measurement in Monte Carlo and see that, you know, there's a scaling function associated with some measurement. And that scaling function gives me an exponent that's 0.6717. Plus or minus something. And I look that up on a table of universality classes, and I say, this is a 3D XY universality class. So that seems boring. But the question I'm asking is, well, one interesting thing that's happening here is these fractional particles that I've been talking about are gapless. And so do those gapless fractional particles affect the critical point? And if so, this is kind of interesting because now we have a quantum critical point that, you know, depends upon the emergent fractional quantum fractional quasi-particles of the system even to exist, right? And, I mean, theories about this type of stuff go way back. I think probably back to when I was in high school, basically. And, you know, people have proposed that these things could exist for a long time. And this specific one is called an XY star transition. And the sort of formal way of thinking about it is that, you know, we have physical bosons, which are these things, and then we have the fractional particles. And you know, each fractional particle, when it annihilates another one, so two fractional particles give us back the boson. So formally you could think of this, well, this is not very formal, but you can think of this in a mathematical way as the boson being the square of the two fractional particles. So each one of these is like a square root physical boson. And now you can ask the question, which isn't obvious, you know, what's undergoing the XY transition? Is it the physical boson, or is it these emergent fractional bosons? So we have a smoking gun test for this, and that's because of this aspect of universality. And that smoking gun test is, I basically look at the correlation function. And so if I do a physical boson-boson correlation function, I know the form for this thing, it decays as r to the d minus 2 plus eta, where eta is the anomalous dimension. So let me leave that eta in there, and then let me write the physical bosons as a square of two of these fractional particles, these red things, that's the phi field. And then if I square this thing without the anomalous dimension, then these two, the left and right hand side, or the top or the bottom, should be equal. So when d is equal to 3, because it's a 3+1 transition, then this implies that my anomalous dimension, as measured in the physical case, has to be equal to 1. And so that's a very easy prediction to check, because in the regular XY model, the anomalous dimension is basically zero. It's known to be about 0.03. So this is a direct consequence of fractional particles, if they exist at a quantum critical point, you know, affecting the universality. And it doesn't mean that it exists. But you can calculate the value, you know, because it's universal, you can look at a field theory. And you can look at a field theory for basically a bilinear ON model and calculate the anomalous dimension in that case. And people have done that with some six-loop calculation, which, I mean, programming supercomputers is tricky, but like it seems way more tricky to do a six-loop calculation. I don't know. Anyway, the number you get out from these guys, these papers, is 1.473. Okay, so without belaboring the points regarding the simulation, we can basically measure this thing by looking at correlation functions of the boson creation annihilation operator. Here's the correlation function on a log plot here. And you can extract a very high accuracy the anomalous dimension by looking at the functional form of this thing. And one point is that you have to eliminate some of your smaller system sizes. So I'm basically looking at, probably I think I eliminated this point even. You're at like 18 by 18 by 3 up to 48 by 48 by 3. Okay. So you need simulations of this size. But the gift you get from that is a highly accurate representation or highly accurate numerical value of your anomalous dimension. And in any other system that you study that has conventional transitions, that thing's about zero in the XY class. And so that's a very highly non-trivial confirmation that it's actually the fractional particles. It's not the physical bosons. It's the fractional quasi-particles that undergo that quantum phase transition. So they are the things that affect your universality. Okay, so there's also topological effects. So maybe I'll just go through this really quick. So fractional particles can wind around the simulation. Remember, in the space direction. They can also wind in the time direction. I showed you this picture before. This is winding number equals zero because you haven't crossed the sort of boundary of the spatial boundary of the system as you wind in imaginary time. But all your world line configurations include these non-trivial winding numbers. And these are a highly topological, they're very non-local objects. And there's also a distribution. There's a distribution of winding numbers. And in fact, all the winding numbers squared, the average, this is this universal scaling function that I looked at to tell me I was in the XY universality class. So one point is that the fractional bosons affect the distribution of winding numbers. So the probability that I have zero windings, one winding, two windings. And in order to study this non-trivial topology, I can basically look at a comparison of my fractionalized system with physical bosons, and I can like simulate the simulation with another simulation where I combine physical bosons into a fictitious like squared boson, okay? And so let me just walk you through this. So if you have an XY star critical point, your physical bosons can wind in any configuration. So here's winding number one. This is D plus one. Now the fractional particles, the big red particles, are the square root of this. I mean, so it takes two of them to wind in order to give you one physical winding number. But I'm claiming that it's the fractional particles that give me the quantum critical point. So now let me take a regular conventional XY transition. This is an entirely different model. And let me force the bosons to wind in pairs. So if I force the bosons to wind in pairs, it's like I'm creating an artificial bigger boson where my physical bosons are actually like mimicking the fractional ones, right? And so it's like I'm simulating in some restricted manifold the simulation that's actually the physically interesting case. But because I believe these things are universal, then the probability distributions of those two cases, the one where I have the fractionalized bosons and the one where I've restricted physical bosons to be even winding, should be the same. And so here's confirmation of that. Here's my universal function for the simulation of the simulation, which is the black line. So that's the artificial fractionalized bosons. And here's my difficult simulations of the Kagame lattice Bose-Hubbard model that gives me the XY star transition. And you can see they follow exactly this function up to some point where these magnetic particles that I somehow know exist start giving me finite size effects. So this is the first winding number distribution. This is the second winding number distribution. And I think the point is that if I don't restrict myself to the sort of paired bosonic sector, then I get a function that's not anywhere near being the same as these universal functions. So this is somehow numerically less obvious than the value of eta. But what this shows is that, you know, even though these fractional particles are gapless, they're undergoing this transition, they're becoming gapless, they still affect the topology of the system. So there's still a sort of emergent topological nature to that quantum critical point, which has to do with basically exactly these types of universal things. So anyway, that was that also got a bit technical. So I'll just end this XY transition part. Fractional particles cause entirely new types of quantum phase transitions. They're universal, but they're more than being a different universality class, although they do have different exponents and everything, but they're just a different paradigm for quantum criticality, right? It's the emergence of the system, the emergent feature of the system that gives you quantum criticality. They also give you observable topological effects. Okay, and this has some consequence. So if you're looking at a regular gapless, you know, fractional particle, and you're wondering if you can use it for topological quantum computing or something, this shows you that, you know, this topology, this non-trivial topological effects can still survive in the presence of a gapless particle. Okay, so the critical exponents are universal, and that's one of the most interesting things. So for example, this XY star transition that I just talked about, and I measured this eta to some high accuracy. If you could measure this thing on a candidate crystal with this type of order, which is actually predicted to occur in this Herbert Smithite by Severe Sachdev, you would know the universality class, and you would know that it corresponds to exactly the physics that I've talked about here, just by basically measuring this one number. And that's the power of universality. It doesn't matter if you're in a crystal, or if you're in a simulation, or if you're in a field theory, right? This universality sort of transcends all of these things. And so just let me end with that. Again, we have spin liquids. They're fun to play with. We have these huge simulations that let us, you know, really look at the microscopic details of this stuff. And we can study all sorts of interesting effects. But I think kind of the take-home message is, you know, this large-scale simulations of these models, I mean, in some sense, they're like a virtual experiment, but they can really bridge the gap between, you know, all these different field theoretical treatments we do. I mean, many sorts of different exotica are possible by constructing field theories that are based on these symmetries you're looking for. Simulations like these ones can whittle these down into some, you know, interesting Hamiltonians that might have some physical relevance. And, you know, universality connects these all. If we measure a universal number, then it's going to be the same universal number across the whole spectrum. And I think that's one of the nice things about the emergence in these systems. Okay, that's enough for now. Thanks.
So, Roger, yes, so for this transition from superfluid to spin liquid that you have, XY star.
Mm-hmm.
So the really surprising thing is that it's a second order transition. Not necessarily that you have fractionalized quasi-particles in this transition, because you have fractionalized quasi-particles in the spin liquid to begin with.
Right. So you could have an XY transition. You could have a transition from a non-fractionalized paramagnet to a superfluid that's XY type. So in this sense, we've created the fractional particles, so we know they're there. So the surprising thing is that they affect the transition, and that it's continuous and that it's of XY type. But I mean, if you just ignore the fractional particles, and you could say, you know, if it's just the bosons undergoing the XY transition, then it could still be an XY universality class, right? But then it equals zero.
The question is, can you imagine any other scenario for this transition? Let's say it's still a continuous transition. So it's still a transition between a superfluid and a fractionalized spin liquid, but somehow fractional quasi-particles do not play a role in the transition.
Yeah, I think that's an open question. Whether or not it's the physical bosons or the fractional bosons. Like, how do you know a priori which one undergoes that transition? So we know it's in the XY universality class from the initial exponents, but it could easily, I'm probably not sophisticated enough to know if it's precluded from the theory, right?
No, yeah, just naively, but you may think that since it's a continuous transition, so and fractionalized quasi-particles exist in the spin liquid, so they have to appear at the transition.
Yeah, but they don't have to affect the transition. They don't have
right.
to affect the transition
but
because
they don't have to.
They don't have to, yeah. I think the surprising thing is that they do affect the transition, whereas before, you know, it was up in the air, like, We you know, it could have been the physical bosons that gave you the XY transition, and that eta is a smoking gun. Like there's no way that you can screw that measurement up, right? It's like 1.5 instead of zero. So I don't know.
More questions.
I want to come back to this question of order parameter or non-existence of the order parameter that you talked about in the beginning.
Okay.
From one point of view, couldn't you just say that the order parameter is whatever is the effective field that you use to describe the system? But in some sense, you told us what that was, I thought. You told us it was some sort of loop gas or something. So can't we say that those loops are playing the role of the order parameter?
I guess that's exactly what I think I'm saying. I mean, a loop gas is what gives you this thing that I was calling the quote-unquote order parameter. But I mean, the loop gas directly gives you the topological entanglement entropy. So I'm not sure it's, maybe the topological entanglement entropy is just a concise way of stating
the order parameter for a specific type of flue gas. And if you have a different type of flue gas, which is a different gauge structure, then you have a different gamma in the topological entanglement entropies.
But that's a different thing, because the entanglement entropy is just a number or a coefficient parameter in an expansion. But it's not a dynamical variable itself.
Oh, I see.
Whereas the order parameter in something like the more traditional kind of spontaneous symmetry breakings provides a dynamical variable in terms of which you can give the effective theory of that system.
So I think that's true. You can do that. But I think one of the points of this is that you don't have to know anything about the microscopics of the system to measure this gamma, right? Like, this thing's totally basis independent when it's measured from the entanglement entropy. And in this case, I constructed a model that has these features. But in more general cases, you have a Hamiltonian and you have no idea what's going on in the ground state principle. It might look like a liquid, but you don't have any idea of the emergent structure. So like I've argued that we have a loop gas, and then I've proven that we have a loop gas. But the more general case is that you have some sort of liquid state, and you're searching for what type of loop gas it is, or what type of topological order it is.
So if in general you knew what replaced the loop gas, or if it always was a loop gas, that would solve the mystery? Is that...
If you know the structure of the loop gas, then you know everything about the system.
Then you wouldn't need to be looking for an order parameter in addition to that.
But I think it's only toy models, what I would call a toy model, that has a clear sort of loop structure. And one example is, in this case, I know I have a single loop structure that corresponds to the fractional boson. But I also see that there's another loop structure that corresponds to that magnetic defect from the two plateau system. And I haven't argued for that loop structure here. I mean, this is a weak argument maybe, but I haven't even motivated the idea that there's a second type of loop structure in this thing. And I didn't even know that existed until we look at the thermodynamics of that entanglement measurement. So in that case, that's exactly the purpose of measuring the entanglement entropy,
right?
Is it tells me that I have a second type of loop structure here.
But could it be that all these mysterious things are ultimately string models or loop models as opposed to
all
point,
these
point
mysterious
particle models? Well, the ones you mentioned, all the different non-Landau liquids or whatever you called them.
I think the subset of GATT topological spin liquids are all loop gases. But there's all sorts of other algebraic spin liquids. And I don't know, are the fractional quantum Hall states described by a loop gas? Maybe Anton knows. I don't think they have a loop structure like this. I don't think so. I think this is a subset of topological spin liquids.
So I have one other question. You referred to something called chiral, what was the word?
I just meant some chiral order parameter.
Chiral order parameter. Yeah, could you give an example of one of those?
I mean, just an order parameter that spatially spins, basically. Like, I mean, a magnetic system.
Oh, that's what you mean.
System?
It's not a pattern. It's not a chiral pattern in the density or something like that.
I just mean a symmetry. Yeah, I mean, in the density or in the spin direction. I mean, I'm just using that as an example of something that is sort of non-obvious if you're looking at sort of a lattice, you know, if you looked at a lattice picture of spin configurations and you're wondering what kind of order it might have, there could be some symmetry breaking with respect to chirality that's difficult to see.
Yeah, I'm asking for maybe I'll ask you later, I'm asking for a particular reason because, you know, entanglement entropy came out of quantum gravity originally. It's a kind of gift to condensed matter from quantum gravity.
Thank you.
I'm hoping that... I'm kind of hoping that condensed matter can give a gift back in terms of something like CP violation or parity breaking or something like
but
that.
But those spin two lattices then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't understand the...
So well, I'm thinking this chiral order parameter could be an example.
Sure, we can talk about it. Yeah.
Are there any more questions? Before we thank Roger, let me just remind you that there are post-colloquium snacks downstairs in the bistro. So let's thank Roger once again.